Eric Brooks, curator at Ashland the Henry Clay Estate. I just sat in on your presentation about the vices of Henry Clay. What's the general reaction when the folks come in and they're going to hear about A Man in Full? And when we're talking about A Man in Full, Henry Clay kind of warts and all.
I think people really enjoy that. I think to some degree people like the idea of hearing the true story or going behind the scenes, if you will, getting the private dirt, whatever. I think that there's sort of a natural appeal to that. We've been sort of inured in our society today to want to dig that information out, whether people want it out or not. And in Henry Clay's case, he's long gone enough now that we can do it without any real concern about whether he would have worried about it. And I don't think he necessarily would have. I think he knew full well what he did, and everybody else knew. So anyway, it's a fun presentation to do, and I think people do really enjoy it.
You've obviously researched Henry Clay forever and ever, and you come across a document. Anything that ever is like one of those oh wow moments? Kind of describe that.
Oh sure, yeah. I have oh wow moments every now and again, and they're what makes the job so worth doing. I mean, when you come across something that just totally blows your mind, the best example that I can come up with off the top of my head was about, this would have been probably 2008 or 9. We were in the midst of the Kentucky Abraham Lincoln bicentennial. So I've been researching Henry Clay and Abraham Lincoln and their connections for a while. And I had been looking for a snuff box that I know that Henry Clay's son, John, gave to Lincoln. He sends it to Lincoln in 1862, and I wanted to track that down. Since that time, I figured out that Mary, when Lincoln died, eventually gave it to a friend in New York. I don't know exactly what happened to it from there, but it went to New York. So it's in New York State, New York City area somewhere, or was. But I'd been looking for that. And that was sort of, I thought, the creme de la creme. And that was it, the one piece that was Henry Clay's that became Lincoln's. Well, since that time, I've discovered that Cassius Clay received a cane from Henry Clay that he then later gave to Lincoln. So there was another piece. Well, that's in the New York Historical Society. In the midst of all of that, another piece came to my attention that I had never seen anything about that is far more important to our story. It is a copy of The Life and Speeches of Henry Clay, Volume 1, 1842 edition. It is inscribed on the flyleaf, "To Abraham Lincoln, with constant regard to friendship, H. Clay, Ashland, 11 May, 1847. So now I've got an artifact that appears to have gone directly from Henry Clay to Abraham Lincoln, and establishes potentially a connection of friendship that had never existed before. That is the only such artifact that exists anywhere. It's hugely important, and hugely important to that story that I had been working to tell, and I had no idea it was even there. It just showed up. So, you know, those things happen, and when those things happen, it reminds you that no matter how much you do, no matter how much research you've done or digging, there's always stuff out there, and I hope there always is. If I ever got to the point, it ever became the case that there was no more, it would be kind of boring. I mean, it would be kind of like, okay, well, it's all done now. I mean, you sit and look at it, but the chase, the knowing that there's more there, that we're constantly digging up stuff every day, is really what makes this worth doing and makes it so much fun.
You had kind of made the point where he had vices, but all men of that time were doing these things. Explain that.
Well, the things that Henry Clay did, drinking, dueling, gambling, etc., were commonly done by people of his social class, of his geography, men of the South, etc. The other thing is, I think, realistically speaking, that there are very few people who are truly pure. I mean, everybody does something. They may not have done as much as Henry Clay, may not have had the luxury of the opportunity. I mean, if you're not real well off, gambling becomes a real big issue. I mean, you don't have much to gamble. You have a lot to lose when you lose it. So, but I think most people have things that you can point at and say, that's not great. That's a bad habit or an unfortunate characteristic or whatever. And it makes Henry Clay very human to know those things and know that he knew these were problems for him. And, you know, obviously we live in a world today where anything and everything gets picked out, magnified, and widely overblown in many cases. So to look at this is a way to remind ourselves that that's not a new thing. It's been going on a long time.
And you handled it very well about the idea possibly that Henry Clay sexually exploited his female slaves. Kind of expound on that if you don't mind.
That is a subject that we've been researching Henry Clay and slavery for a long time. It's one of those things that we've been trying to uncover, bring back more and more of. We've certainly done that in the tour. We've got a long way to go. That's a challenging thing to do. Those sorts of records can be difficult to find, and oftentimes it requires a thorough reading of and thinking about those records in order to really understand what they're trying to tell us. And so in the case of Henry Clay and the sexual exploitation of enslaved women, the records we have are not complete. They don't just, you know, it's not Henry Clay didn't just write a document, sign it, saying, hey, I did this. So we have to take what's there and ask questions about it. We have to evaluate it and ask, was this said because somebody had an axe to grind or because they were trying to make political points? Or was this said because they legitimately believed it to be so? I certainly think it's quite possible that he did. Many men who enslaved women did. Probably, realistically, more men by far than we know about, and maybe most men. And it was just something that was there. It was possible. Would not have been surprising to people of Henry Clay's sort. I mean, they all, I mean, it was unspoken, but I think many of them did it. And it was, in many ways, the darkest, one of the darkest and most horrible aspects of slavery in general. There are an awful lot of cases of enslaved women taking action that is very drastic and very sad because they knew that could happen. Great example. There was a man named Peter Still who was enslaved across the road from Ashland at a brickyard. He came from New Jersey, was captured by slave hunters there along with his brother. Peter Still was brought to Kentucky and enslaved at this brickyard. We know about him because he created a slave narrative, which talks about the enslaved at Ashland. For a long time, it was thought that they were kidnapped away from home, taken away from his mother or whatever, taken off the porch. Later research discovered that, in fact, his mother, Peter's mother, knew they were coming. And so she took off with her daughter, and she left Peter and her brother, and she did that because, as bad as it would have been for Peter and his brother to be enslaved, what could happen to her daughter was so much worse that she was willing to take that action. One of the reasons we know a lot about this today, or I know a lot about this, is that Peter happens to be an ancestor of Valerie Still, of UK basketball fame. She's actually come to Ashland, and we've met about it. She's written about Peter some, and she helped me find the slave narrative that he created, which is a very, very important source for us at Ashland, a remarkable document. So we know these things happened. The evidence is there. We have to be willing to accept it. We have to be willing to attribute belief to it where we can, and we have to be willing to tell that story. I mean, if we don't, these people disappear, and that's not fair. That's not right. So we have to do what is the right thing and the important thing and make sure that their story survives.
Did you ever find any evidence where someone tried to blackmail Henry Clay?
I cannot, off the top of my head, cite specific examples, but yeah, I would say there were people who, you know, made statements that sort of indicated they might have more information that they could follow up with or whatever. I mean, he was the kind of figure that, at the very least, they would have said, they might have said something like, you know, we can tell more and, you know, cost Henry Clay votes or whatever. I don't recall specific examples where people were saying, either you pay me or I'm going to release more. I mean, it may be there. I could see that happening. But I can't recall those specific cases.
And finally, maybe the dynamic between Henry Clay and someone like Andrew Jackson.
Well, Henry Clay and Andrew Jackson knew each other well. Were basically opposed to each other almost from day one. Jackson was many of the things that Clay feared most. He was a general, a military man. He was someone who was willing to use force very readily, without much justification at times. He was someone who was willing to ignore treaties or laws, international laws, etc., if he felt it was the right thing to do. And Henry Clay worried about that. He saw people like Jackson as having the potential to become dictators, to take over the government, use the military to essentially garner power to themselves. And so he worried a great deal about that. They were also just opposed in their politics. Jackson was a small government Democrat. Henry Clay was federal government first, states' rights second, power to the federal government Whig. And so they were diametrically opposed in many ways. And they become the two points around the two part of which the two-party system comes to exist. And that was seen even by people like Henry Clay is potentially problematic. I think we can see today the result of that, and that it has become in some ways very problematic.
Okay, and one more. The irony, I want you to address the irony of a man known as the Great Compromiser being in duels.
Well, the irony of Henry Clay as Great Compromiser being in duels, that the duels were very personal matters. And as far as that was concerned, that was okay. I mean, he could do whatever he wanted to, you know, for his own personal honor. The compromises came about out of a deep sense on Henry Clay's part of desiring to do the most for the country. And he felt that the best way to do that was by doing things that the most people would agree to allow, that would come together on. So that meant compromise, and he did that very well. The downside to his compromise is that the people who suffered for them or benefited not at all from his compromise were the enslaved. His compromises basically perpetuated the system long enough that when the war was fought over it, which was essentially inevitable, the country could survive that war and emerge from it intact. The downside is the enslaved remained enslaved much longer and paid the bill for that opportunity. So they paid the bill that ultimately leads to their own freedom, basically. So that's what has to be kept in mind when thinking about Henry Clay's compromises.
Eric Brooks, thank you very much
for
your time.
Welcome. Thank you.
All right.